Roberta Blevins, and this is Life After MLM, a podcast where we worked in the stigma of failure in an industry systemically designed for you to fail. Join us as we dive into the real-life stories of survivors, experts, and advocates, as we debunk the common myths and fallacies of cults, frauds, scams, and multi-level marketing. Hey, Hun Buds and Hun Bros, we have another deep dive into MLM history with Sean Munger, with this episode into the life and times of Glenn W. Turner and his scams, including Costcott Interplanetary. Sean also has an incredible YouTube video that goes over all of his research with all the photos and videos. It's incredible. So we are going to be streaming that as a live watch party in the Discord coming up with Sean. So make sure that you have joined and you are a member. And once you join, make sure you also go into the rules and you check the rules, because if you don't, you won't be able to chat and enjoy all of the fun stuff. And if you just want to watch it on your own, there is a link to that video in the show notes as well, so you can find it easy. The Amway Tools Cult scam episode is one of the most talked about and favorited episodes, literally 2 years running. And so I reached out to Sean to let him know. And I said, if there's ever any other MLM or scam history that you come across that you would like to share on the show, let me know. And he was like, you know what? I'm actually working on something. Let's talk in 2024. And so this is that episode. We're presenting it to you today. I am so excited. I am so excited. I love these sort of episodes, and I hope that you enjoy it too. There are so many interesting revelations about early scamming and what MLM looks like today, and it's just a fun ride. So I hope you enjoy this as much as I enjoyed talking to Sean and then also subsequently editing this episode for you guys to listen to as well. I also want to say thank you to every single person that reached out this week and said, I heard you talk about Mars Hill. You have to listen to this podcast. Thank you so much. It was overwhelming how many of you reached out. So the support of the listeners of the show is incredible. Thank you guys for being amazing. I'm going to be listening to that podcast. It is on my radar. We will be doing Mars Hill content in the future. So if you were a victim of Mars Hill, or you know a lot about it and you want to share, hit me up and let's make some content. I'm going to listen to that podcast, and there will be Mars Hill content in the future on Life After MLM. And without further ado, I would like to introduce you to Glenn W. Turner and arguably one of the earliest instances of the stupid name check of MLM, Costcott Interplanetary. Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Life After MLM. You guys are going to be so excited today because I just have to tell you, the episode that we had with Sean before is not only like the top episode of 2022, but it was the top episode of 2023 as well. It was the Amway Tools scam video, or you made the video, but it was our podcast episode. Literally, I cannot tell you how many people have found Life After MLM because of our chat, Sean. I am so happy that you're here back today to talk about another historical MLM. Just to add to this, I love learning about the history of MLM. I am so excited to learn more about what we're going to learn about today. Welcome to the show, Sean Munger. It is so great to see you again.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Roberta, and thanks for having me on again. That's really awesome that so many people have found the show, and particularly that there are people who got out of Amway as a result of our talk. And that's hugely gratifying. And in fact, one of them contacted me directly.
Amazing.
And just, I know, just wonderful to know that, like, you know, historians are not just locked up in an ivory tower, you know, looking through dusty books. It's like, once in a while, we actually have an impact on the real world. So.
I mean, I ask people all the time, I'm like, you know, like, what's your favorite? And they're like, the Amway Tools cult. Oh my God. Mm. Oh my God. Like, that just was like, what? And I think it's just because it validated everybody's feelings about all the shady stuff that we know happens. And then here you come in with the historical fact from these historical records, from letters and accounts and audio, and prove that this is actually what's happening. And it was fantastic. And so I had to reach out to you and say, again, this show is the top show of the year. Again, this is the one that everybody was like, this is the episode that I found you. This is the episode that changed everything for me. And I said, I would love to have you back. And you were like, well, funny you should mention talking about coming back on the show.
Yeah, funny you should say I'm working on it. Yeah.
So why don't you tell us what you're working on?
Okay, so I am doing another deep dive video that's going to be out at the very end of February, hopefully, if all goes well. And it's about Coscot Interplanetary and its sister company, Dare to Be Great! Exclamation point. The exclamation point is part of the name. It's Dare to Be Great! Exclamation point, Inc. And these were some of the early MLM scams and some of the most outrageous, really, in MLM history.
I'm really excited to talk about this. I know that people understand or have heard Coscot Interplanetary. If you've heard The Dream, the podcast The Dream with Jay Marie, you've heard this. You're going to hear a lot of names that you've heard before. I've done some videos on really some of this stuff. And honestly, Coscot is such a cool business to look into. I'm so excited because they were one of the early pyramid schemes that set the early pyramid scheme rules. That are now sort of morphed into what we have today. So this is like so early MLM, and I'm really excited. So Sean, please, you are a fantastic storyteller. Take it away.
Okay. So really, this is the story of, there was one man behind these scams, and his name is Glenn Wesley Turner. And he's truly one of the great con men and fraudsters in American history. And in some ways, he's even more brazen and outrageous even than Dexter Yeager, who was the main character of the Amway Tools cult story and who I focused on in my previous video. And Glenn W. Turner, in fact, is one of the few MLM kingpins ever to go to prison, though it was not technically for the Coscot scam, but we'll get into that. It's related. He did do time in prison, so that is a distinction that he has that unfortunately is not shared by other people who have arguably committed frauds equivalent to his.
Right.
He's passed away now. He died in early 2020. As you pointed out, the Coscot story is important to the history of MLMs, and particularly because of its legal history. So here's why, and I think you know this, but just to make this clear for the listeners, and I've heard this on your show, you know how the MLM hucksters are very fond of claiming, well, this isn't a pyramid scheme. Pyramid schemes are illegal. Well, the very narrow definition of what they think is a pyramid scheme is basically Coscot. It's set the rule for that. That was established in an FTC decision. It was called In Re Coscot Interplanetary. This is from 1975. And this is actually, we're going to get through the whole thing, but this comes pretty much at the end of the story or almost the end of the story. So it's not really the beginning of it. In fact, the FTC was somewhat late to the party, as we'll see. But this decision was the precedent. And I think this is what you said you were reading about. This was the precedent for the famous Amway FTC decision from 1979. And that's the one that Amway and most MLMs hide behind when they want to pretend that they're not pyramid schemes. So in order for that decision, that Amway decision to exist, there had to be a definition of an MLM that was too pyramid-y to be legal. And that definition was established in the Coscot case. So that's why it's important. So just for the record, that case established, and the legal decision is online, is easily available, but it established what's called now the Coscot test. And basically it has two prongs. So the first one, the participants must pay money to the MLM company in return for the right to sell a product. And then two, the participants must pay money to the company in return for the right to receive rewards that are unrelated to the sale of the product to ultimate users. And basically in exchange for recruiting other participants into the program. So if you satisfy these two conditions, you're an illegal pyramid scheme. And a pyramid scheme that even the Hunbots out there will agree is a pyramid scheme. So this is the standard, basically.
Right.
It's outdated, you know, and there's lots and lots of talk today about, well, we need to change the FTC decision. And that, you know, that's a discussion that's going on today. But this is, and again, 1975, that was almost 50 years ago. So the rules have not been updated for 50 years. And
no,
it's kind of amazing that they haven't been.
And based on these two prongs, pretty much every MLM out there is a pyramid scheme.
Exactly. So, it's that second prong is the test of how MLMs argue that they're not pyramid schemes, because the test is flawed, as we know. MLMs are pyramid schemes. Often they're cults, as we've seen. But in the antiquated law that the FTC and other courts have been applying, this is the test. And it has to do with, it's the second prong about the, what are people being paid in exchange for? And so the MLMs will say, oh, well, we are selling retail products. See, look, we have a product. So we're not just giving money just for recruiting, of course. So it comes down to an argument about that specific thing. How much is enough? How much is not enough? That was an issue in Amway. That's an issue in basically every decision. So that's the legal framework. So cost cut is important because of that reason, but also you may not have known this, but Glenn Turner also introduced the phrase and the concept of fake it till you make it into MLM culture. And we definitely encountered this concept in the Amway story, and it comes up over and over again. About every other guest of yours mentions it on the show. But basically, Coscott and Dare to Be Great instructed their salespeople to go to great lengths to get the check. That was their phrase, get the check. So that included especially buying or at least driving expensive cars, jewelry and furs, and you know the usual stuff that MLM salespeople do.
Yeah, so, you got to look the part.
Right, exactly. So Glenn Turner, who had a knack for creating phrases, was the origin of this phrase and this concept, fake it till you make it. Coscott was ostensibly a cosmetics company, but at least as we know, the cosmetics were kind of the window dressing. That was the product that the MLM pretended to sell in order to argue that they were a pyramid scheme. But what's interesting, at no time during its entire existence, at least the existence during which Turner was involved, from 1967 to 1973, at no time during that span of time did Coscott even earn half of its revenue from product sales. The high was 42%, and that was in 1970. That was the largest share of their income that they ever earned from product sales. This is your Uber pyramid scheme. It's very clear. What I quickly found as I was researching this is to understand Coscott, you have to understand the person, Glenn W. Turner. And it surprised me, and it'll probably surprise a lot of people to know that in the early 70s, he was actually one of the most famous people in America. He was super, super famous. He was everywhere, especially in Florida, but absolutely just ubiquitous.
Really?
Yeah. In 1971, Life magazine did a spread on him. It was not the cover, as is sometimes reported. He was not on the cover. In fact, I think it was Jesus Christ Superstar was on the cover, that one. I'm using the article as a source, but it's a 9-page feature article. They sent a photographer. There's all these lavish photos,
wow,
some of which were taken on his plane. This is an interesting detail. His home base was Orlando, Florida. I'm going to be talking about that and why. But in 1972, there was a billboard just outside of Orlando, which said, "Welcome to Orlando, home of the unstoppable Glenn Turner," and a huge picture of him.
So he was just known for being a good salesman? What was he known for?
Yes, that's exactly what he was known for. What's interesting, later in the story, we're going to see he runs for Congress. And if you go to the Wikipedia page about that particular congressional race and it lists the candidates and who they were, it'll say Glenn W. Turner super salesman. That's how Wikipedia identifies him. So
wow.
He was known, and he wanted to be known as like the greatest salesman in the world. And for a while, arguably, he probably was. So, I mean, this guy had a billboard to himself put up outside of Orlando, Florida. So you cannot use the word modest to describe him.
And also, like you mentioned Florida, how come all this shady shit goes down in Florida?
Actually, there's a number of reasons why it is now. Part of it is their income tax situation and that kind of thing. But there are specific reasons why Turner picked Florida and particularly picked Orlando, which I'm going to get to in just a moment.
Okay.
But I just want to contrast, like, this is the guy who was super famous. And so many people around the United States knew and the world knew him because he operated in foreign countries, too. By contrast, when he died right before the pandemic started in January 2020, it took months for the national media to notice. And his obituary is like something like two sentences on legacy.com.
It's wow.
Total fall from grace.
Right. I'll say how the mighty have fallen.
Oh, totally. So at his peak in the early 70s, Turner boasted that he was worth $100 million or maybe $200 million. He probably wasn't, but he was clearly very rich. When you start to get into these numbers, particularly, I mean, $200 million is a lot of money for the early 70s.
Yeah.
And exactly how many hundreds of millions of dollars you have kind of stops mattering after a while, at least in some context. So it's not, you could come up with a lot of different numbers for what he was worth or what he claimed to be worth, and it's hard to pin those down. But he was undoubtedly very famous. He was a guest of honor at banquets and conventions. He addressed the Model United Nations at one point. He headlined Rotary and other service club conventions. He was a guest of honor at those. He gave speeches and rallies. Like he flew everywhere all over the U.S. and to some foreign countries on a similar pace. Like imagine a presidential candidate like the week before the election. That was his life. He did that all the time. He would hit states and just jet around the whole time. He was on the road something like 4 or 5 days out of the week.
How weird.
Every week. It's crazy. Also, he was very popular. Like when his plane would land at an airport, he'd get out and people would mob the plane to get near him. Probably what helped for this is that he carried a roll of $100 bills and he would pass them out like among the crowd that would come to greet him.
So, wow.
So yeah, you're gonna, if you pass out $100 bills.
Like children to an exploding pinata. Like just, oh, candy.
Totally. Yeah.
Wow.
So if you want to be popular, that's, you know, that's a good way to do it.
Just hand out $100 bills. Yeah. Duh.
Yeah, totally. So, and total 1970s. I mean, this guy, you had to see this guy to believe him. So if you just imagine this, neon colored, double knit polyester suit, usually bright colors, usually red, orange, or green. And we're talking about the kind with like those huge lapels, like.
Yeah, the huge lapels.
Yeah, those gigantic, like 8-inch wide lapels. And this is a 3-piece suit. So he's got the matching vest and double breasted, big, wide, garish tie like they wore in the 70s, usually like with the gold and yellow stripes or whatever.
Yeah.
He wore ivory colored calfskin boots with high platform soles and this absolutely outrageous toupee. William Shatner in the later Star Trek movies type toupee. I mean, just. It looked like a cat was perched on his head. It was just unbelievable.
Wow.
And he always wore a giant rhinestone encrusted American flag on his lapel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that checks.
Yeah. So, and the politicians who picked up that, I can't confirm that he was the start of that fad, but clearly that's...
An early adopter, if nothing else.
Yeah, an early adopter, yeah. So this guy really was extremely charismatic. So like absolutely off the charts charismatic. And part of why he was such an effective speaker was because of his voice. So not only did he have this super thick Southern drawl, but he also had a very pronounced lisp. But this was an asset for two reasons. First, his voice was extremely memorable and no one else in America sounded like this guy. If he started talking, you knew it was him. And second, because of his speech impediment, you had to pay attention to his words very closely in order to make out what he was saying. So as a result, when he talked, people tended to pay considerably closer attention to his words than you would for anyone else casually talking. Because actually a lot of conversation is context clues and you react to body language or whatever. But because his voice was hard to understand, you had to really focus in on what he was saying. And as a result, his message really sank in.
Now let's look back in the year 1920 and 30s. Well, Napoleon Hill wrote a book called Think and Grow Rich. All right. I grabbed this book in the year 1966. And it says anything the mind of man can conceive and believe it can achieve. Now, I didn't have enough sense and education to look at the copyright of that book, what he meant and what other people interpreted that book, and I interpreted it was different. He meant in the year 1930s and the 40s, people could become a multimillionaire. Well, I thought it meant today. I didn't know it was 20 and 30 years out of date, and therefore I believe it. Now, other people with more education, really more ability at that point in my life, read that same book but did not do anything with it because they glanced down and they saw that one little statement printed 1920, 1930, 1940, whenever a particular book was printed. And they said, oh, well, no wonder. That was back when the giants could still make it, before factor too high. But all I saw was the good stuff, the meat, and I grabbed it and I run with it. And other people looked at it the wrong way. Now, that's a shame.
His message, of course, was basically you can be rich. And that was really the totality of what they were selling, was basically you too can be rich. That was in a nutshell. So very similar to Dexter Yeager, Turner kind of distorted and embellished the basic facts of his life story in order to make him seem like a great salesman and a great achiever. This is very common. And part of his story was that basically, part of the reason why his voice was so distinctive is he was born with a cleft palate and a cleft lip. We don't use this term anymore, but at the time, you know, mid-century, they would call it a hair lip. He had three operations in his life, fairly early in his life, to try to correct this. They didn't all go completely according to plan, but they left him with this lisp. And in fact, the company, Coscott, was so fond of, they were joking that like they should count his hair lip as basically an asset on the company books, because he was able to make so much hay out of this idea. And what he said was his life story was really part of the sell, because he would say, like, you know, if a sharecropper's son with a hair lip can become a 100 millionaire, anybody can, was his thing. And the term hair lip, we would not use that today. I'm using that just because that's the term that he used. In his story, there's actually a lot of references to disability and things like that in terms that have now been made obsolete. Some of those terms do come up in his story. But basically, he made a lot out of this disability and also his upbringing. He said, you know, sharecropper's son, always the first two things that you would ever learn about him was that he had this disability and that he was the son of a sharecropper. Every single speech, everything.
Well, you know, you say that he's the son of a sharecropper, and that actually reminds me, because when I did my TikTok about him and about Coscott and the rules, one of the products that I showed was sharecropper cologne. It was one of like the flagship products of Coscott Interplanetary. So that's very interesting, because I was curious why he would call it that, but there we go.
It was kind of a motif, actually, because in one of the books that are my sources, I'm going to be talking about it in a minute here, but he had several authorized biographies. He wrote his own book later on. But you'll see, if you look at this book, there's on the pages facing the chapter headings, there's this line drawing of a farmer pushing this old style wooden plow. And he also had that. It was a little cartoon. It was also in his office. It appeared on the Coscott promotional stuff. This was a motif. It's meant to make you think of sharecropping and, you know, this poor farmer type of stuff. So this was a major part of the narrative of his story. So I did try to drill into this specifically because these, especially in the mid-century sales culture, you can't really take this kind of stuff on faith. I tried to establish the facts. He was born relatively poor and his father was a farmer, but you can't really take the whole of his story on faith. So I actually had my mother help out here. She's a genealogist. She knows how to trace this kind of stuff. So I had her, not telling her anything about this guy or, you know, what I was looking at. I had her kind of research the basic facts of Glenn Turner and his family, and we were able to verify some of it at least. So basically, he was born in Columbia, South Carolina. This is in the height of the Depression, 1934. But their family lived most of their lives in Marion, And of course, the Deep South was a very grim place at the height of the Depression. And actually, a majority of sharecroppers in the South were white, even at this time. But Turner does seem to have exaggerated how poor his family was. They lived in a house that could be defined as a shack. I've seen pictures of it. He bought it later on in life. But they weren't on the verge of starvation or like not having clothes or whatever, which he would often either state or imply in his often retellings of the story.
Yeah. Very common theme with people telling their life story on stage and things. Yeah.
Exactly. And he did misrepresent sometimes his lack of education. He would often claim he was a fifth grade dropout or an eighth grade dropout. However, I found him in the Marion High School yearbook for 1951 when he was in the ninth grade, but he doesn't appear in any yearbooks after that. So it seems that he probably dropped out of the ninth grade. But still, being a ninth grader at age 17, that's definitely a candidate for probably today we would look at, does he have a learning disability or something like that? But again, this is pre-desegregation South Carolina. So society very different than it is today. So he joined the Air Force briefly. This is during the Korean conflict. He never went overseas. Military doctors discovered he had a perforated eardrum, which is probably related to the cleft palate situation. And the time where this was happening is actually important because we generally tend to think of the 50s as this very prosperous time, lots of job opportunities in America. But actually for middle-class men that didn't have a lot of education, the job openings in the 50s were actually pretty slim. So unless you were going to, education had a big boost because of the GI Bill. But if you weren't educated, basically you had three choices. You had military, factory work, or sales. And so guess what he chose? He became a salesman for a sewing machine company. And this was actually like a viable career path in the 50s and 60s. And it was because of the commission structure. And this was fairly new. It wasn't new as an economic innovation, but it was new in the reach that it had at this time. Companies liked commission because they didn't have to pay salaries, of course. Salesmen, if they were successful, and they were all men except for Avon and Mary Kay, that's how those got kind of walled off on their own categories. But salesmen liked it because their earnings were directly based pretty much on their own efforts. So I make a big deal out of this in my video. And it also, I mentioned this in the Amway Tools Cult story, that sales culture was becoming really big in the 50s and especially the 60s. And it really was a culture unto itself. They had their own language, their own value system, their own kind of mythologies and heroes. And this is where we get the Horatio Alger type story, the idea that the great salesman was someone with an innate calling to the profession, which is why some of the MLM kingpins like Yeager like to tell stories about how they were salesmen as children. You know, oh, I went to the construction site and hawked bottles of Coke for 10 cents a piece. You know, that's where that all comes from. That's very much a part of their mythology, their kind of self-mythology.
Right. Born to do this kind of thing.
Exactly. And if you want to observe how this culture worked, and not just economically, but socially, there's a pretty famous documentary that came out in 1969. It's called Salesman, and it traces the lives of Bible salesmen in New England.
Oh, wow.
And it's a sort of a depressing documentary, but it's also very interesting. And it was parodied on, there's a show, I think it was on Netflix, called Documentary Now, which is a comedy, like a mockumentary. They parodied this.
Oh.
Their shtick is they parody famous documentaries like Grey Gardens and Thin Blue Line and that kind of stuff. And Salesman was one of the ones that they parodied. But I watched the whole film recently, and it's kind of depressing. Like if you're hawking Bibles in rural New England in 1965, that's a hard road to hoe, basically.
Totally.
These guys like grew up in this culture, and this sales culture is really important to understanding history of MLMs. Like there's a scene in the film where they go to a sales meeting, and it looks like an MLM rally, and it sounds like it, because a salesman will get up and be like, you know what, I'm not going to make $25,000 this year. I'm going to make $65,000 this year. And I'm going to give my wife a mink coat and I'm going to drive a Cadillac. Rah! You know, and everybody cheers.
Yeah.
This is where the MLM culture got all of this stuff, is from mid-century, particularly 1960s sales culture. And I think that's not as well understood today as it probably should be.
Do you ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet just for anyone to find? I promise it's more than you think. Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members. It's all being compiled by data brokers and openly sold online. This can lead to a lot of problems, including identity theft, phishing attempts, harassment, and unwanted spam calls. But now you can protect your privacy with Delete Me. Signing up for the service is super easy. Just provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. They send you regular, personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. I got my report, and I was floored with the results. Of the 105 data brokers they checked, 83 of them had my data. Delete Me then removed 173 listings of my personal data off the internet, and they make sure that it stays off too. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me at a special discount just for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and use promo code MLM at checkout. The only way to get the 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and enter code MLM at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/MLM, code MLM.
So, of course, in sales culture, what's the biggest, highest, most validating thing you could ever do as a human being? It's to get rich.
Be rich.
Yeah. But there's another element to this, too, because when you talk to Amway distributors, if you're unfortunate enough to ask what they do, the stock answer is they say, oh, I own my own business. You don't, actually. I know we talked about this last time, the IBOs or the International Bowel Movements or whatever that the thing is. But, you know, they don't really own their own business. But that's part of this culture. The ultimate freedom, the ultimate achievement is, you know, to have control of your destiny this way. So in telling his life story, Turner faced kind of a problem when he talks about this period when he's a sewing machine salesman. He didn't try to hide it or pretend that he didn't make a living, because after all, he has to be an ace salesman in order to keep up the mythology. But if the punchline is that his life was worthless until he discovered MLM, he has to kind of downpedal how successful he was as a salesman.
Right.
And he was. He earned $40,000 a year in the early 60s, which is the equivalent of about $400,000 in today's money.
That's so much. That's really good money.
Yeah, that's a pretty good salesman. Incidentally, Turner commissioned, I mentioned this earlier, he had an official biography. He commissioned a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist to write his own story. It was a book called Con Man or Saint? Which tells you automatically what, what was already swirling around about him. This was published in 1969. And this, oh my God, this book is infuriating. The author, his name is John Frasca. Even though he had won a Pulitzer Prize, he abandoned all semblance of journalistic objectivity when he went to work for Turner. I had to read this book for doing my research, and this is hands down the worst sales motivational book I have ever read. And I read Don't Let Anybody Steal Your Dream by Dexter Yeager, and also The Winner's Circle, and I read a bunch of Og Mandingo books as well, and this is the worst of them.
But have you read Girl, Wash Your Face?
Oh, no, I haven't read that one.
Well,
that sounds terrible. So this kind of literature is so bizarre. And this one is a weird example of it, because the author reduces everything in Turner's life to a very simple parable. The world is always against him. He's always the underdog. Everyone always tells him that he can't or that he'll fail, but he always is right and then proves everybody wrong. So every single character in the book, except for Glenn W. Turner, is a relentlessly negative naysayer who constantly berates him, only to change their tune when they realize how rich and successful he is. Even his wife is portrayed this way in the book, which begs the question, if she was so negative, why did he stay married to her? Actually, they did get divorced later, but still, it's so bizarre.
Wow.
So bizarre, this story. So anyway, I don't recommend reading this book. It's made me want to just throw it across the room. It was just, I'm like, oh God, again, we have to go through this again, every chapter, the same thing.
Wow.
Same thing. So anyway, about 1966, Glenn Turner, successful in the sewing machine sales business, suddenly discovers the glowing divine guiding light, Alpha and the Omega, the path to riches and success. Then, of course, it is, drumroll please, holiday magic.
I knew that. Yay! Holiday magic comes into the picture.
Absolutely. So when he encounters holiday magic, evidently he was super impressed because he turned over he had formed some kind of business in the sewing machine sales industry. And he sold that business to his partner for $1 as soon as he found holiday magic and immediately became a holiday magic distributor. So if you know holiday magic and its founder, William Penn Patrick, it should not surprise you that Glenn Turner immediately got hooked on motivation and self-help. And of course, the book that did it, you could probably guess, it was Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill.
Yeah, Think and Grow Rich.
For a while, Turner was this huge disciple of William Penn Patrick, hugely devoted to him. He does not, however, seem to have followed his politics. I know we've talked about this, that William Penn Patrick was a member of the John Birch Society, ultra-right wing, or at least an endorser of the John Birch Society. In fact, I drilled into that question because after my Amway video came out, someone challenged me. It's like, how do you know William Penn Patrick was a member of the John Birch Society? And I found a source that did validate it. So it does seem clear that he was. In fact, the reason why it's ambiguous is because that came back to haunt Patrick, because he tried to challenge Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination for California governor in 1966. And he wanted to take away that as a weapon that Reagan could use. Oh, you're a member of the John Birch Society. So he kind of buried the evidence, basically. Oh. But he was involved with them on some level. And Turner was actually a pretty moderate Democrat, which surprised me and probably surprised a lot of people. He opposed the Vietnam War, for example. So the politics are not all just one stripe. I mean, we talked a lot in the Amway story about how closely it was wedded to the religious right. Turner was very religious, you know, what you would probably consider a fundamentalist, but that did not seem to seep into a lot of his political beliefs, as we would expect today of someone with that background. But anyway, so he sees the potential immediately for big money in holiday magic through the recruiting scheme. In fact, he was only with them probably about a year or so, maybe a little bit more than a year before he split off to form his own multi-level marketing company. And that was Coscott Interplanetary.
I think he was with them for, yeah, like a year and a half or something. And what I had found was that the team that he had built in Holiday Magic, like the size of it would be like equivalent of like a $1 billion business today. Like that's how big he got in Holiday Magic. Mm-hmm. Like massive mega hun is what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And he branches off like the Amway boys.
Right. Exactly.
Of Neutralite branches off and says, I can do this better somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. The exact reason why he branched off is very telling. Because Holiday Magic, this is in 1967. They'd been active about 3 years. They were starting to run into trouble through state level investigators. The FTC was not really on the scene yet. I'll talk about that. But state attorneys general across the U.S. were investigating Holiday Magic for being a pyramid scheme. So to provide some deniability against them, Holiday Magic tinkered with their sales plan a little bit. And what they did was they slightly increased efforts to actually sell cosmetics, as opposed to making all of their money from distributorship fees. And they told their distributors to spend more time on selling retail. And Glenn Turner thought this was a waste of time. So in other words, he bolted Holiday Magic because it wasn't a pure enough pyramid scheme to suit him. He thought, well, why waste time selling actual product? We can make more money selling distributorships, which is what he wanted to do. So he wanted to get out from under that very slight change to the Holiday Magic rules, which is amazing, in my opinion.
Wow. And also like legal sniffing around. So he probably wants to distance himself from the pyramid scheme and start a new pyramid scheme that people aren't sniffing around yet.
Exactly right. Yeah. And in fact, that's his strategy, is when the law starts to catch up to you, just jettison and form a new company. And we'll see him do that.
Yeah.
In fact.
Yeah. Rebrand, reformulate, relaunch.
August of 1967, Glenn Turner founds Coscott Interplanetary Inc. in Orlando, Florida. They started out with 4 employees. And there's some super interesting historical background here. And believe it or not, this has to do with Disney. So Walt Disney died December 1966. He was actually not cryogenically frozen, as is a popular legend. he was buried. I think he was buried or cremated. But at the end of his life, he was working on developing Disney World in Orlando. And the centerpiece from the beginning, the plan was the centerpiece was going to be projected Epcot Center. And Epcot is an acronym for Experimental Community of Tomorrow. This is your classic mid-century futurism. So if you think of people like Buckminster Fuller, who was super hot in the mid to late 60s, that kind of thing was all the rage. You know, this is the world of tomorrow. This is what we're going to be living at. Like the World's Fair in New York in 1964 had all these futuristic buildings. And kind of, if you think of the 2001 Space Odyssey, the aesthetic of the way like the chairs looked and the way the interiors looked, that was the rage in the mid 60s.
Walt was really into that stuff because they even had very like also Tomorrowland at Disneyland, mm-hmm. but they also had a lot of this mid-century futurism, like the House of Tomorrow, mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff. So yeah, totally. I'm right there with you.
Totally. And like the cartoon, The Jetsons.
Yes.
Is a parody on that kind of aesthetic. So that all this stuff was in the mix in the 60s. And Florida had just experienced a boom based on the space race. Orlando is the nearest major population center to Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral. That had been the centerpiece of the space race in the early 60s. So if you think of Alan Shepard and John Glenn and that sort of thing, the Wright stuff, that kind of thing. But Glenn Turner was absolutely just, he loved this space kind of stuff, this futurism stuff. And the idea of Epcot Center, he just was over the moon for Epcot Center. And in fact, he chose the name Coscot, which supposedly stands for Cosmetics Company of Tomorrow. He wanted to associate that with Epcot, and the K was meant to make it more memorable. So that's why I started with a K.
Okay.
And the second word, interplanetary, was supposed to stress how futuristic and space age the whole thing was supposed to be, because of course, astronauts' wives, when they travel on the rocket ships to outer space, astronauts couldn't be women, of course, they would need to have perfect makeup in space. So
interplanetary beauty.
They stress this whole thing. Yeah, totally.
I've always wondered about that. So thank you.
That's why it's called that.
The space race and the obsession with all like the mid-century. Like that's all here. Mm-hmm. That's wild. Coscot and Epcot. Like, wow. Mm-hmm. I was always like, why would you call a makeup company interplanetary? That's so dumb.
It doesn't make any sense. But yeah, this is why.
But at the same time, Cosmetics of Tomorrow, Cosmetic Company of Tomorrow, interplanetary because of this space. Wow, that is so cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's true. And sure. A unique window into his mind. In fact, there was a fun fact that Glenn Turner once said that he hoped that we would discover life on Mars, and he hoped that Martians turned out to have two sets of mouths so that he could sell twice as much lipstick.
Wow.
So he milked this association with Epcot, which was, I remind you, an association that did not really exist. The early sales literature for Coscot said that once Epcot Center actually opened, Coscot would have its corporate headquarters in Epcot Center.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, the Disney Corporation, in fact, had to issue a cease and desist letter to get them to stop implying that they were somehow endorsed or associated with Epcot Center and Disney.
I mean, this is like so scammers going to scam. Like they're like, we're just going to do it until they say we can't.
Yeah. So, of course, in reality, Epcot Center didn't open until 1982. Incidentally, my family and I were among the first guests. We were there in, I think, early 83. It still very much had that you know, New York 60s World's Fair type of look to it. It's changed now, but in the early 80s, it was still a hangover from that era. Turner also copied Holiday Magic's sales plan and their sales manual. And in fact, he copied it so literally that typos that appeared in the official Holiday Magic sales manual, the same typos also appeared in Coscot's sales manual.
Okay. So let's just like take it back a second. So you're telling me that not only did Glenn W. Turner coin the phrase fake it to make it, but he also originated the copy paste of the Hun message. Like he literally just took it, copied, mm-hmm. didn't change anything, didn't even fix the typos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's such a Hun move.
It's crazy.
He's such a trailblazer.
Yeah, totally. Totally. This started in 1967, and actually for the first couple months and through most of 1968, Coscot had zero product. There were no cosmetics at all. They were working on it. And in fact, he even hired.
It's coming.
No, it's true. He hired an executive that had cosmetics experience. Her name was Jerry Jacobus, and she began calling herself Lady Coscott.
Oh my god.
Her idea was that everything or nearly everything that Coscott sold should have mink oil in it. That was their selling point.
I think there's an MLM out right now that still sells a mink oil like based product.
I'm not surprised. The problem for them, great idea, hire this executive. The problem is that in 1967, there was pretty much one mink oil supplier in the whole United States. They were located in Wisconsin, and they could not make enough of this stuff to enable them to sell products until more than a year after they started in business. So,
God, I mean, he even originated like the FOMO of the early start. Like we're seeing MLMs right now who are like, oh, well, we're supposed to launch in January, but it's looking like March or April now. MLMs still do that. So it's wild to see that like he really is this trailblazer for actually how these scams still pull the strings.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. So they eventually did start selling cosmetics, but they never manufactured cosmetics. I thought this was an interesting detail that there were basically at this time, there were cosmetics manufacturers basically for hire, and they would slap the label of any paying client on whatever generic lipstick or cold cream that they were making. And again, that sort of shows you the little emphasis that was put on retail products. They didn't care where they got it. They just sort of hired it out.
Just private label, put our logo on it. Thanks, that works.
Yeah. Coscott had no products in 1967 and most of 68. And for that time, they were a pretty rare example of a pure pyramid scheme. All of their money in this period came from initiation fees from distributors. So no product at all. An entry-level Coscott distributorship would run you $2,000 in 1967. That's the equivalent of about $23,000 in today's money.
Oh my God, that's more than LuLaRoe.
Yeah. Like I know, it's nuts, but it worked. Coscott made $67,000 in its first month. And by May 1968, they had $1 million with no product.
Wow.
So pure pyramid.
Sounds like Transact card.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
No product. Wow.
Being so closely tied to holiday magic, that was a bad thing for Coscott from the beginning for two reasons. First, they were very similar. In fact, if anything, Coscott was worse than holiday magic. And second, by the end of 1968, most of the state attorney's general's offices were investigating holiday magic. And thanks to one guy, the assistant attorney general of North Carolina, he went to a convention of state attorneys general. This was in Baltimore in, I think, 1969. He was from North Carolina. And he told all the other state's attorneys general to watch out for this new company called Coscott. So when that started popping up, everyone, all the attorneys general knew who it was, and they started investigations.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. So also this period, late 60s, this was really kind of the dawn of the consumer protection era. And it was driven mostly by lawyers like Ralph Nader. People forget he was not a politician. He was a lawyer. He had written a book called Unsafe at Any Speed in 1965, exposing the practices of the auto industry. Even more famous lawyer was Melvin Belli. Have you ever heard of him?
No, I don't think so.
He was one of the first real celebrity lawyers in America. And he took on all kinds of companies in products liability lawsuits. So, you know, you find a rock and a can of peas, call Melvin Belli, basically.
Okay.
The FTC was kind of a minor player at this time. Most of the action was at the state level. And by 1968, they were just drowning in complaints about early MLMs, principally Holiday Magic and eventually Coscott. So there really weren't a lot of MLMs out there at that time, but they were disproportionately responsible for consumer complaints pretty much all across the country at this time. So North Carolina was the first state to move against them, and they found a great weapon against them. They argued that Coscott distributorships were technically securities, which is a really interesting argument. So I used to be a lawyer, and I practiced business law, so I know a little bit about, I was not a securities lawyer, but I know a little bit about this. So you probably know a security is like a stock or a bond, like a share in a company. It's basically an investment instrument. And securities are regulated by every U.S. state and by the federal government. But the test for whether something is a security is whether the return or most of the return of your investment depends primarily on the work of somebody else. So it's like you buy a share of Apple or IBM, whatever that share is worth depends on how good Apple or IBM do.
Right.
You know, that depends on their manufacturers and their salespeople, whatever. So in a pyramid scheme, if what you make depends on how many people your downline recruits, do you see how that could be a security? Because it's your return is primarily dependent on the efforts of other people. So the next time you get hustled by someone selling an MLM, ask them if they're selling unregistered securities.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Like, are you involved in securities fraud?
Yeah. No, I don't do securities fraud. No, thank you. And again, North Carolina was the first to move against them. So to avoid being shut down on this securities issue, Coscott voluntarily agreed to stop selling distributorships in North Carolina. This is in 1969. But remember the securities thing because it comes up again later. So as investigators were closing in and Turner was churning more and more money through Coscott, he decided, just like we talked about earlier, he decided he's going to distance himself from the legal problems by developing a new scam. This one would be, guess what, a motivational course. And that would be its sole product. So no cosmetics, nothing like that. Don't even bother to sell cosmetics. He just decided to develop a sales motivation self-help course and sell that through the MLM model. And this was called Dare to Be Great! !
Right.
It was going to be called Dare to Be Big, but there was a Coscott distributor who wrote to the company saying that she weighed 300 pounds and she was already big enough, but she wanted to be great instead. So Turner loved the idea and decided to change the name to Dare to Be Great.
Oh my God, what? Wow. That's
interesting little anecdote.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So this, again, same thing as the Amway Tools cult, great time to get into this business because they were able to leverage the relatively new technology of cassette tapes, which are better than LPs, much better than reel-to-reel because they're portable and they're very cheap to make. So Dare to Be Great had four courses. They were called Adventures. There was Adventure 1, like Venture Roman numeral 1, and an Adventure Roman numeral 2, and Adventure Roman numeral 3, et cetera, all the way up to 4. Does this sound kind of like the Scientology bridge?
Yes. It's like OT levels.
It's exactly the same thing. It's exactly like the OT levels. If you were unfortunate enough to get scammed into buying Dare to Be Great, basically what you would get would be a briefcase full of cassette tapes. Famous anecdote that came out in one of the trials, one of the witnesses at the trial had been hustled into buying Dare to Be Great, and it turned out that he was deaf. But they still sold him a briefcase full of cassette tapes. And he didn't know when he gave over his money, that's what he was buying.
Oh my God. I know I said he was a trailblazer. And like, I feel like I manifested it when I said that because he just keeps doing all the things that they still do now. They still ignore like ADA. They still don't care. They still just, it's not accessible. It's not like friendly to everyone. Like it's the same as it was then, as it is now, in terms of the business structure and in terms of the tactics and the bullshit. Oh my God.
Very much so. So basically, I mean, you know what you get. If you buy this thing, you plug in the tape, pretty much wherever the needle drops, you're going to hear Glenn Turner talking about how you have to believe in yourself and you can succeed. And the copy was mostly cribbed or paraphrased because these guys weren't very original. Most of them were paraphrased for the big self-help motivational books that were popular at that time. And of course, the chief source was, guess what? Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, which itself was a scam, by the way. We don't really have time to go into that, but
it's another episode for another day.
Yeah, just totally. It's just a scam built on scams. So here's where it gets really nuts. Coscott and Dare to Be Great distributorships were marketed in rituals that were known as GO meetings. And GO is an acronym, Golden Opportunity. They held them in hotel ballrooms, in private homes, on buses, and especially on airplanes.
Airplanes?
Yes. The plane ones were the worst. Because as Turner got richer, he bought Learjets. The Learjet was the ultimate status symbol in the early 70s. So he bought like a whole fleet of these private jets and they would fly them around the country and get prospects to go on these planes and attend a sales pitch while they were in the air, these GO meetings.
Okay. So he buys a fleet of Lear jets, the ultimate status symbol to be like, not only do I have one, I have a whole fleet. Would you like to fly around on my Lear jet and just listen to me talk about how I got my Lear jets? Like this business opportunity pitch, but he's not on it.
Yeah, he wasn't always there. It was his salespeople, but it was like, we bought all these Learjets. You too can be rich if you join this opportunity.
And it's like they have those meetings at Starbucks now. Like imagine.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And you can't leave.
Yeah. It's crazy. I know. You're a captive audience.
At a Holiday Inn, you might be like, oh God, this is not what I signed up for. I'm going to go to the bathroom and slip out the back. Yeah. You're on a jet. You can't get off a jet. You can't hide.
Yeah, unless you have a parachute, you're stuck.
Wow. Oh my God.
It's crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. And these meetings were just rapacious, super high pressure sales tactics. So the salespeople, of course, they promised the moon. You could make $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year selling distributorships and recruiting. And they would, of course, they would play the tapes of Glenn Turner talking and really play up the rags to riches angle. And they would have these chants and they would all get together on the plane and go, money. And that was a major thing that they did. It was just crazy. They would paper a city in flyers advertising these go meetings and then land and then herd the prospects like cattle onto these planes. But it's even worse than this because sometimes they would ask the prospects to take out cashier's checks for $5,000 a piece before they took off in case they were so enthused during the flight that they decided to sign up then and there. So not only were you a captive audience, you had to pay $5,000 basically to get on the plane for them to take your check.
You just hold it's that crazy. Refundable thing. If you decide not to sign up, then you don't hand over the check. But obviously people are handing over the checks. That's why they're bringing them. That's why they're on a plane.
Totally.
Like this is all so sinister. Oh God, keep going.
The salespeople, they encouraged prospects to go into debt to buy in. This was a really common tactic. So a lot of the complaints, the consumer complaints involved people who went into debt to join up because $5,000 in 1969 was a lot of money.
Wow.
There's not that many people that have that in cash laying around.
No.
In fact, there was one report of recruiters being encouraged to drive prospects to the bank to take out a second mortgage so that they could pony up the initiation fee, even if they couldn't afford it.
That's very Scientology.
I know. It's crazy.
Wow.
It's crazy. Just like any other MLM, Coscott Dare to Be Great did not pay expenses. So they encouraged people to bring other potential recruits to these go meetings and to pay those people's way. That was very common. So if you've already paid $5,000 to join up, you've probably gone into debt to do it. And now you're going out of pocket to pay the travel expenses of your family and friends to travel to the next go meeting so that they can sign up. So it's just this cascading failure. It's crazy. All kinds of complaints. From the very, very beginning, people were writing letters to Coscott headquarters demanding their money back, claiming they were swindled. One guy went into hock for $5,000 to join up and made a total of $12.40. Another famous incident, a guy was writing letters demanding his commission checks. So Glenn Turner personally sent him a check for $0 with void written on the check and signed, God bless you, Glenn W. Turner. So just shameless.
Wow.
Absolutely shameless. The Life magazine reporter who trailed Turner on his plane asked him if this kind of thing bothered him, if the complaints bothered him. And Turner's response was, quote, does it bother George Washington that so many people got killed when he fought for independence? I'm not asking for their lives. I'm only asking for their checks. So he actually said that.
Oh my God. What a dick. That's just like, he's just sounds like such a peach.
Yeah.
No wonder nobody cared in 2020 when he died.
Yeah, really. I know.
This is how this guy got famous, scamming people and calling it sales.
Yeah, pretty much. So he wasn't totally obtuse. He understood that states and eventually the feds were going to come after him. So October of 1969, he hires a fixer. And he got the biggest and most famous lawyer in America at that time on his side, F. Lee Bailey, who I don't know, you've probably heard
yes.
of him.
I do know F. Lee Bailey.
He's most famous today for his participation on the O.J. Simpson Dream Team. He was the guy who cross-examined Mark Furman. widely credited with being the key to Simpson's acquittal. But Bailey was very famous long before that. So he defended a guy named Sam Shepard, not the playwright, but another guy who was convicted in 1954 of murdering his wife. That case became the basis of the TV show The Fugitive and later the movie with Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
So Bailey was involved in that. So Bailey was totally charmed by Turner and became sort of the compliance officer for the companies. And basically his job was to try to outwit the state's attorneys general who were closing in on them. But it was kind of a thankless job because there was pretty much no escape. And his only hope, Bailey's only hope really, was to negotiate some sort of deal with the FTC. This is where the feds come in, hoping that they were going to make some tweaks to the sales plan to satisfy them. And then the FTC would put an agreement in place that would supersede enforcement actions by the states. That was their strategy. But in 1969, Richard Nixon comes into the White House, and in part because of Ralph Nader, the FTC was overhauled and greatly increased its oversight of consumer protection. They didn't do much consumer protection before that time, but especially they started to get focused on pyramid schemes because those were the number one complaints that the FTC received day in and day out at this time. So there was a lot of focus on this. So this is how the FTC starts to get into the mix. And Bailey, in fact, negotiated not one, but two separate deals with the FTC that would have left Turner's schemes alive. But before they went into effect, the FTC blew up both of those deals and refused to sign them. And they were now seeing the writing on the wall that somebody was going to take down Turner, and they didn't want to be seen as placating him. So that's why they scuttled the deals at the last minute. And when those deals failed, Bailey left the company. However, his involvement with Coscott was to have some bad consequences for him, as we're going to see in a minute. It was not the FTC that killed Turner's operations, but the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. So if you remember that securities argument that pyramid schemes are actually an unregistered security, well, in early 1972, the SEC sued Dare to Be Great, not Coscott, but sued Dare to Be Great at a federal court in Portland, Oregon. And they chose that venue because a judge in Portland had ruled in a private lawsuit that Dare to Be Great was a security. So they wanted to piggyback on that precedent, basically. And they chose Dare as the target because of their emphasis on product was a lot less than Coscott's, which was sort of a sham to begin with. But at least they could say, look, see, there's a warehouse full of cosmetics. We really are selling something. But Dare to Be Great was not really that. So in August 1972, a federal court ruled in favor of the SEC. And this was instant death for Dare to Be Great. They had to shut down immediately, nationwide. So this is half of Turner's empire was dead pretty much instantly. And at this point, now everybody pounces at once. So the SEC decision is like ringing the dinner bell for a feeding frenzy. FTC finally gets into the act. SEC decides, well, that worked. Let's try Coscott now. So they sue Coscott on the same theory, the securities theory. And then there's also a class action lawsuit on behalf of defrauded distributors filed in Pennsylvania against Coscott. And that one turned out to be the real killer. So Turner's new lawyers, they were hot shots, but not as big as Bailey. They were kind of trying a strategic maneuver. They would agree to the certificate, what's called a certification of a class of plaintiffs. This is kind of legalese about how class action lawsuits work. Normally, a class action defendant would resist the certification of a class, but Coscott wanted this to happen because their hope was that this would freeze all other litigation pending all over the U.S. against Coscott. It was a stall tactic. They didn't know what they were going to do when the class action was decided, but they figured they could at least turn off all the other lawsuits. But the problem was that the class of defrauded plaintiffs was thought to be about, at this time, about 75,000 people, and the lawyers estimated that it would cost at least $50 million to satisfy them. And as they started, you can see this coming, as they started to drill into Turner's assets, you remember he boasted he was worth $100 or even $200 million in 1972, they discover, oops, he's actually not worth that. They could, in fact, scare up about $5 million tops, which is not even a drop in the bucket. So at this point, Turner knew that he was going to go down. So that raises the question, where did it all go? Well, he spent it all. He bought jewelry, he bought cars, Rolls Royces and Cadillacs, whereas MLM people love Cadillacs.
He had a fleet of Learjets.
Totally. And he would buy them on impulse. Yeah. It's like, oh, I like that plane. I think I'll buy it. Yeah. Really crazy. He bought real estate. He built a castle for himself on a lake outside of Orlando.
Of course he did.
With turrets and everything. It was modeled after the Sleeping Beauty Castle at Disneyland. Part of it still exists, at least the boathouse, which was kind of the main residence after a while. It wasn't all a boathouse. that you can see it on Google Maps today. And of course, he sort of paid lip service to philanthropy and gave away some stuff. There's a description in one of the sources I found of Glenn Turner's office in Orlando, and it sort of reminds me of, you remember Back to the Future Part 2, where they go into the alternate timeline and Biff is like this super rich and powerful guy and they're in Biff's yes. pleasure palace and it's this garish. That's basically what this was like, except 70s.
Like a Vegas penthouse in a cheap hotel.
Totally. So sofas with zebra stripe upholstery, it's a marble fireplace, there's mood lighting, of course. There's a painting of a rocket ship, because of course, this 1960s futurism. There's a hidden doorway that leads to his private barbershop. I don't know what he needed a barbershop for. He didn't have any hair. I guess manicures, I guess. There's a miniature Rolls Royce on his desk, which is actually a music box. And when you click the spare tire, it plays The Impossible Dream from Man of La Mancha, which is another MLM trope.
Oh my God. The Don Quixote musical.
So his next legal battle came not from the FTC or SEC or state's attorneys general, but from the post office.
Oh, no.
Yeah. U.S. Postal Service in 1970.
Mail fraud.
That's exactly right. 1973, federal prosecutors in Florida indicted him and 9 other people from his companies on various charges of mail fraud. And one of the defendants was F. Lee Bailey, who had left the company. But this was important because this is not an action against the corporations, but against the people themselves. And the stakes were that they could actually go to jail. So this was not going to be just monetary fines. Shortly after the mail fraud charges, the IRS jumps into the mix. They freeze and attach all of Turner's assets, what few he had left. So nowhere else to go. Of course, he decides to flee overseas. I researched this and it's not entirely clear where he was going. But in June of 1973, Glenn Turner and his bodyguards, I think there were 2, they were arrested at the airport in Frankfurt, Germany. They were changing planes, and they had $36,000 in cash hidden in their boots. So,
oh, man.
So when all else fails, just stash the money in your shoe and go to Germany, I guess. So Turner spends 3 weeks in a German prison. The authorities are wrangling over who had the right to put him away. He was wanted on criminal charges in Britain as well. Interpol was involved.
Oh my God.
So if you've got Interpol, if you're an MLM grifter and you've got Interpol chasing, you screwed up somewhere.
Wow.
So ultimately, he is extradited back to Florida. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the trials. There were 2 of them. Whole book was written about the first trial, which lasted 9 months, 230 witnesses, 40,000 pages of trial testimony. Most expensive case in Florida history up to that point in time. But suffice it to say, the government was a little overconfident. There was so much evidence against Turner and that they presented it so exhaustively. And it took so many months and months to do this. The jury was completely overwhelmed. So this was really like kind of like the O.J. Simpson case where they basically sat there for 9 months. And there had never been a trial like this before. It had lasted so long. Their lives were completely disrupted. It was just a real imposition for them. But the key development was one of the defendants, there was a Coscott executive, and he offered to testify on behalf of F. Lee Bailey, who was one of the defendants. And this created a conflict of interest because he couldn't testify in front of a jury that was going to decide his own guilt or innocence. So the judge decided the easiest thing to do would be to drop Bailey as a defendant from this case and then try him again later. But because they couldn't tell the jury why Bailey had been dropped, it looked like the government had decided that their case against him was weak. And the defense lawyers just rested their case immediately, hoping that the jury would draw that conclusion. So 6 days of deliberation, jury's hopelessly deadlocked, and the judge declares a mistrial. So 9 months, millions of dollars for nothing. Turner's second trial is scheduled for late 1974, but it's postponed into the new year. In the meantime, incredibly, he decided to run for Congress. So...
The fraudacity of this man.
He tries for the Democratic nomination for the U.S. Senate for the state of Florida. So he buys a van, paints it red, white, and blue, and tools around the state claiming he is the no deals candidate. Presumably no deals with the evil government, because of course his defense is, oh, I'm being persecuted. You know, the government wants to wipe out. I'm too successful. They want to wipe me out because I'm a businessman who showed everybody that they could be rich too. That's his shtick, basically. Incidentally, he also said in his campaign announcement, he said he was the first candidate to be indicted before he runs.
Ooh.
Yeah, someone else has tried that tactic since then.
There's so many parallels. Like, there's just so many.
I know.
So I'm glad that you made the connection. Okay.
Totally. He didn't get very far. He came in fifth. This is in the primary. It's not the general election. Came in fifth with about 6.5% of the vote. He insisted that he would run as a write-in candidate in the general election. That never works, and it didn't work in this case. I couldn't even find the number of votes he actually got. I don't think anyone recorded it.
I mean, it's just hilarious to me for a candidate to think that if it was too hard for you to circle in the bubble next to the name, that writing it in completely of your own volition is easier or better. Like, come on, buddy.
Right, exactly. But it feeds the narrative that, you know, oh, the establishment is against me and, you know, they won't let a candidate like me on the ballot. You know, I mean, it's just part of the stage.
It's so funny. Oh, man.
Okay, so the second trial starts in August 1975 in Tampa, much less flashy than the first one, in part because Turner was now mostly broke, and the big lawyers who had represented him before, they decided they couldn't take time away from their lucrative practices to represent him again. So he ends up representing himself, which never goes well. So if you can imagine, you know, you walk into a courtroom and this guy in a neon orange double knit polyester suit and calfskin boots.
Dinner plate lapels.
Yeah. And a huge William Shatner toupee gets up and talks in his very distinctive voice about how he's being persecuted by the government. That's basically the trial. So
I'm imagining like Donna's dad from like that 70s show. Like that, yeah. Just that caricature of a person, mm-hmm. like defending themselves in a pyramid scheme case with this ridiculous suit.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's crazy. So after 6 weeks of trial, the government's starting to get nervous. Bailey was already out. He had petitioned a court to drop the charges because of the delay. He argued that he didn't have a speedy trial, so they decided not to retry him. But behind the scenes, even from the beginning, behind the scenes, they were trying to get Turner to sign a deal. They finally agreed to a plea deal in which Turner pleads no contest to a charge of selling unregistered securities. This is a felony, but the key is that it could be reduced to a misdemeanor by a judge if it seems clear that the defendant did not know that he was selling unlicensed securities. Of course, I'm sure he did know, but in simpler terms, he gets off on a technicality. So this short circuits the trial, but Turner possibly would not have been convicted anyway. It probably would have ended in another hung jury. And that class action lawsuit in Pennsylvania, it was settled for $240,000. That's for 75,000 defendants who lost somewhere between $40 and $50 million. So not very much. And the lawyers took most of that. So Turner avoids jail for the time being, but he was broke. Coscott had filed for bankruptcy. It was eventually sold to an unrelated owner, limped along for a couple more years, and then goes out of business. Stripped of his company's real estate, most of his money, Turner lives for a while in the boathouse of that Orlando castle, and he tried to run for state-level office again twice, 1976 and 78. He failed each time. So after all this is over, clear case of closing the barn door after the horses had left, the FTC finally issues the Coscott decision, which is kind of where we started. And this is the decision I mentioned at the beginning. And it's interesting because in the decision itself, the FTC admits that they acted way too slowly to stop the scam. Turner learns nothing from this whatsoever. 1979, he starts another pyramid scheme. This one was called Challenge Inc. And it was a junior varsity rerun of Dare to Be Great, selling a package of motivational courses. In fact, part of them were the self-same tapes as Dare to Be Great. So together with his former bodyguards, one of the ones who'd been arrested in Frankfurt with the money in his shoe, Turner fleeced about $15 million from the residents of Arizona, which is actually not that much compared to his previous record. 1985, Arizona state authorities catch up with him and they prosecute him for this scam. Another trial, he's convicted of fraud. Finally, after 20 years of pyramiding, they finally put Turner in prison. So in August of 1987, he's sentenced to 7 years. He served five. The press stops covering him at this point. I found at least a partial copy of a book that Turner wrote, a memoir. I think it was published in the 90s or 2000s, but a significant portion of the book is poetry that he wrote in prison, which is kind of interesting.
Wow.
And of course, it's, you know, you see the star on the horizon and you have to, you know, you have to dare to be great. And, you know, all of the just the same themes over and over and over again. He gets out of prison, goes back to Florida, and pretty much that was it. He managed to fool people because he often seemed to be very sincere, and he seemed to be very interested in helping people with positive thinking and motivation. He also successfully leveraged, I think, the impression that he was a little bit naive, because of course, when he's caught in these charges, he says, oh, well, I didn't know that my salesmen were making these outrageous representations. He knew. I mean, the thing came from him. So he knew exactly what he was doing. And I think there's an argument that he was even more greedy, craven, and ruthless in his attempts to make money than many of the other early scammers were. Turner said, for example, that it was okay to lie to people if it was for the benefit of the person you were lying to. So that's how he rationalized a lot of this. That explains the driving the people to the bank to get a second mortgage. He also said that he wanted to be the pyramid king of the world.
Oh.
And that if the government shut down one of his schemes, he'd just open another one, constantly jumping faster than the government could stop him.
Well, like right there proves that he knows exactly what he's doing. He wants to be the pyramid king of the world. Like, what else does that mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's so obvious.
Mm-hmm. So in one of the news sources, there was a write-up on him, and there's a man, I'm going to butcher the name, but a man called George Dimitriadis. He worked for Turner for years. He said at one point that he almost worshipped him. He was so taken in by the motivational stuff. But he said, quote, I realized it was a perversion. It was all just greed worshiping money. It wasn't the people. He made a mockery of the whole thing. So Turner actually still has a fair number of supporters out there today. You will probably hear from some of them.
Oh, I hope I do.
So there's people who say that they got a lot of positive life lessons out of his motivational material and that he was an inspiration. When he died in 2020, there was a small kind of titter of discussion on the net, blogs and such, about what a great man he was and how misunderstood he was. And he was railroaded and, you know, that sort of thing. That's the usual, what you would expect, the usual excuses to be. But I think the historical evidence shows that he was a grifter who was uniquely audacious in the way that he pursued what he was after. And everything about him, it's just MLM personified.
Absolutely.
Just absolutely pure. And difficult to find a purer example of pyramid schemes than him.
I mean, I feel like he did become the pyramid king of the world. Like he
briefly
really like set a lot of precedents. The case of Coscott is what sort of tried to bring Amway down. There's a whole nother story that we'll tell about that. Like that's a whole nother thing. But like it sets a lot of precedents. It created a lot of like the early inclinations of what we see today, like even fake it till you make it, even the delaying the promise a little bit longer and keeping people on the hook and being like, oh my God, people will still stay. Like they'll just pay and pay and pay, making $1 million without a product in like the 1970s. Like it's wild.
Yeah.
So I have a question for you. Like what was one of the most surprising things that you learned in researching Glenn W. Turner?
I guess it was kind of the duality of him, that he does seem to have been so incredibly greedy and so just shameless in going after what he was after, which was money. But at the same time, I can understand why people liked him. I mean, I don't dislike him. I mean, I dislike what he did, but I think he would have been a really interesting person to know. And if you look at some of the later stuff, I found some blogs from people who knew him in later years, you know, after he got out of prison and such. And they said that he was just a great guy, a lot of, you know, very gregarious, very fun and folksy. And so I guess the thing that surprised me was I expected to dislike him a lot more than I did, which is scary in a way, because I could see how people could be taken for anything based on the word of someone they know and like. And you know, we talk about in the era of social media, this the sort of parasocial relationships, you know, the idea that someone that you listen to or see or know, or, you know in quotes on social media has a personal connection to you. And I think he was very good at projecting that same thing in long before the era of social media, because when you listen to his speeches and that kind of thing, it sounds like he's talking directly to you. So I guess what surprised me is that he was so audacious and so shameless in the scamming, crossing a lot of lines that modern MLM people would shy away from. And yet he's a villain, but he doesn't seem like a villain. I guess that's a good way to put it.
I could see that. When he got out of prison and decided to just sort of settle down and live a normal life, He never scammed again. He just learned his lesson and became a pillar of the community?
Well, I don't know that for sure. It's because the sources of his later life are very difficult to come by. There is record of him giving motivational speeches, which he could do without, you know, he could do that completely legitimately. I know he earned some money as a consultant, to whom I'm not sure. I don't know. It seems like he had one mode of business, and that was scamming. But whatever he did in later years did not attract the attention of the authorities, for example, or the press. Interesting that, considering how famous he was.
Right.
You know, everybody knew him. He was utterly forgotten.
It's really interesting that he got famous for just being a salesperson. But then I take myself mm-hmm. back to the 1950s and 60s when he was doing this stuff. And that was like a cool job, like being a door-to-door salesman and mm-hmm. like traveling around. It was this like very like interesting life. And maybe to see somebody be so successful at this job was just, you know, the thing that people are like, oh my gosh, like he's just selling things. Look how successful he is. But mm-hmm. I mean, in hindsight, he wasn't really selling anything but a promise and a scam. Got famous mm-hmm. off of
right.
being well known for lying. And when everything came to light, he went to prison.
Yeah.
It reminds me of like the serial scammers we see today, like Billy McFarland or like a Terry LaCour in like the MLM world, just opening up MLM after MLM. Like even this Transact Card thing with Richard Smith, like Richard Smith did RevCard, which was the early inclination of what Transact Card became, which is now called Finmore because they're trying to get away from, it's all the same thing. It's the same tactics that they were using in 1960s, 1970s, that I'm seeing today in the 2020s. It's the same process, the same system, the same funnel, the same steps. It's just modernized now. There's social media now, so it makes it easier. The reach is easier to get. It's not have to be on a radio show. You can be on social media. I mean, imagine Glenn Turner today. And if he was doing Coscott in the now with social media and the way mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. how exponential we see these MLMs grow so fast, where again, like in Transact Card, we have presidents, which is like the highest rank you can be. There are already presidents and there's no product.
Mm-hmm.
The card doesn't exist. There's no product.
Yeah.
So we're seeing that now in the now. But honestly, like mm-hmm. you could have told me that story without any identifying information. And it could have been about any MLM and any scammer getting prosecuted for getting caught for his scams at any time. Like, it's not unique to the 60s or the 70s. And this was, all of this happened before MLMs became legal, which is the secondary protection of the government going, nah, it looks good to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, imagine the government was actually complicit in helping take this down. You've got the SEC, you've got the FTC, you've got all these different entities coming together and working together with the AGs and everything. And all of a sudden it's, well, now it's legalized. And so it's so much harder to get, like,
right.
It's just wild.
Yeah. Well, it was Amway that flipped that script because of they leveraged their association with Gerald Ford.
Yeah.
Again, an accident of history. If those guys had not been caught at the Watergate building, maybe MLMs would not be legal today. I mean, there's a weird chain of, you know, chain of causation there.
Right.
One of the things that I was thinking about is what would have happened if Glenn Turner had not been stopped legally, where would he have ended up? I don't think it's too audacious to say that he would have been president of the United States.
I don't think so either.
Because we see he was already thinking in terms of political power at the height of his fame and influence there. I did find a reference to somebody who said that he was thinking, this is in the early 70s, he was thinking maybe of running for president in 1980. Watergate kind of sidelined him because he apparently expected George Wallace would be the next president after Nixon. Of course, that didn't happen. But if he was already thinking of political power at the height of his fame, you know, politicking is sort of salesmanship by another name. If his whole brand was there's no ceiling, you know, there's no place that you can't go, I think he would have tried to get into a higher and higher position of power. And I think given the media and political landscape, probably not in the 80s, but, you know, today, it would have been much easier for him to achieve political power.
To even think the difference between if he had been running in 80 and instead of getting Reagan, who's arguably pretty pro MLM, whether he knew it or not, but Reagan and his administration was pretty pro MLM. Imagine President Glenn W. Turner, like the kingpin of MLM, being the president when that happened, and how different. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got the lesser of two pro MLM presidents in 1980. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, imagine if Glenn Turner yeah. had been the president in 1980 and what Amway would look like today. It would be like the Amway White House.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
I wonder how Brezhnev would have dealt with Glenn W. Turner.
Just think about even you saying that Watergate, if Nixon had not gotten caught and resigned and Gerald Ford had not been the president, like, yeah. Wow. It is very interesting. The butterfly effect of MLM mm-hmm. and how it came to be and how it became legal mm-hmm. is so unbelievably fascinating. And I want to thank you for adding another piece to the puzzle. I knew a little bit about Glenn W. Turner and a little bit about his time in Holiday Magic and the stories of Coscott and Dare to Be Great. But I mean, just another fantastic historical account of what happened and adding context to questions I've had that I was like, why do they call it Costco? That's so weird. Like yeah, even learning that, I think that was my favorite part. I was like, oh, that's why. That's incredible.
Yeah.
The place we were as a nation at the time, the things that we were obsessed with, the things that mm-hmm. our country was hyper fixated on, like all played into the name of this. Everything, like it's all connected, even though it's not connected. It's just very interesting. And mm-hmm. to find out these early origins of these things from your stories and your research is always just so cool. So I want to say thank you again, Sean, for helping us understand this.
Well, you're welcome. And thank you.
And you're always welcome on the show anytime you have fantastic and fascinating stories that intersect with all of the topics we talk about. I know that everybody probably really loved this episode too. And maybe this will finally like trump your other episode. Maybe this episode will be the top episode of 2024.
Well, who knows? Always love to bring new people into what I know. So
yeah, I think it's fantastic.
So thank you very much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. I really appreciated this. Another piece to the puzzle, like we say. And now I took so many notes. And so I have all these new names to dive into and all these new connections to dive into and see what I can find too. So thank you so much, Sean. Always a pleasure.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to Life After MLM. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And follow us on social media at Life After MLM Podcast or visit our website at lifeaftermlmpod.com. And don't forget to check out our Patreon for exclusive content and join the community on Discord. You can find all of the links to follow in our show notes. Life After MLM is produced by Roberta Blevins. Audio editing is done by the lovely Kayla Craven. Video editing by the indescribable RK Gold. And Michelle Carpenter is our triple emerald princess of robots. If you have a story about a cult, fraud, scam, or MLM and want to be on the show, please hit us up. We would love to help you tell your story and start your healing journey in life after MLM. See you next time, Hunts.